Okay. Good evening, everybody. You're all very welcome to this meeting this evening, and hopefully everyone can hear me clearly. And I'm reading this small print here, the terms and conditions. As we are currently in unprecedented times, can I ask for everyone's full cooperation and to adhere to the guidelines with regards to the conduct of this meeting? Everyone should ensure that their mobile phones are switched off or switched to silent mode, and the use of mobile devices for recording is not permitted. Members of the public should not speak during the meeting and may be temporarily excluded for discussion of in-committee items. Members of the public and press must refrain from using the instant message facility during the meeting, and anyone found to be doing so will be given a warning. Failing to adhere to the guidelines for a second time will result in being removed from the meeting. I would like to remind members of their obligations under the Councillors' Code of Conduct to declare any financial or significant non-financial interests which they have in any item of business before the committee this evening. If you have any such interest, please either declare it now or immediately before the item itself, stating the item of business that it relates to. Having declared an interest, members should leave the meeting by hanging up from the call for the duration of the discussion on that particular item and should not take part in the vote. You will then be invited back to join the meeting once the discussion on that item has ended. The proceedings of this meeting will be audio and video recorded, except where Council is considering any exempt matters. The recording equipment is linked to the microphone system on the computer, so please make sure that your microphone is switched on before speaking. Members are reminded that they are personally responsible for any comments they make at the meeting. Please ensure if you wish to speak on an item, use the instant messaging facility to indicate your wish to speak, and I will bring members in as listed. At this stage, you will unmute your microphone to speak or click the button on the delegate microphone if you're in the chamber. Members should ensure their cameras are switched on when speaking, and cameras should also be switched on when a vote is being taken. I would like to remind members to keep their instant messages to the following letters. Type Q if you have a question. Type P if you want to propose. Type S if you wish to second a particular item. And please refrain from making any other comments using the instant messaging. Following the presentation of the officer's report, the chairperson will call for a proposer or seconder, and this should be done using the instant messaging feature. And please do not submit these until asked to do so, as it may be missed. If two members asked or are there to propose, the first member having indicated through instant messenger will become the proposer, and the second member having indicated will become the seconder. The chairperson will ask the proposer and seconder in turn to unmute to indicate vocally that they are proposing and seconding the decision. And if you need to leave the message early, please indicate via instant messaging feature so that we are aware that this is an active decision and does not indicate a connectivity problem. So that's the small print and rules out of the way. Do we have any apologies?
One from Councillor Hyle.
Thank you very much. Any further apologies? Since there are no further apologies, we move on to agenda item number 2, as the declarations of interest. Are there any declarations of interest? No. So, happy enough. We'll move on now to agenda item number 3, and I'd like to extend a very warm welcome to Janice Galt from the Hotels Federation. Janice, thank you for coming along this evening, and you're very welcome. We'll now hand over to yourself for your presentation. Thank you very much. You're very welcome.
Janice, you're on mute.
Chair, we'll just get this the presentation uploaded here.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes, that's you now.
I think somebody's going to upload my presentation, but while they're doing so, thank you very much for asking me to come along and speak to you this evening. I work for the Northern Ireland Hotels Federation, which is the body that looks after the interests of the hotel sector in the north of Ireland. We currently cover hotels, guest accommodation and guest houses in our membership. And if you just want to flick whoever's doing my slides, if you just want to flick them forward to the first slide, that would be great. Tourism of itself has, you know, we are currently looking back to 2019 because, as many of us will know, we've been in a pandemic really for the last 2 years. So this is the figure that really everybody will use as a marker from which to benchmark again going forward. So in 2019, tourism beat the £1 billion mark, which is a really big thing. never having been done before, growing over a number of years, but I think people were very pleased when that actually took place. Very large amount of spend from visitors from GB, the domestic market particularly high, ROI growing, and then visitors from other places. When I look at the figures for your area, it's about just over £500 million. Actually, half a billion overnight stays, and £84 million. You are the third largest council in Northern Ireland in terms of visitor spend. And if you could just flick on to the next slide, please. So accommodation is really covered by Tourism Northern Ireland, who certify it. There currently is a record 9,627 hotel bedrooms in Northern Ireland, over 145 hotels, and that represents an £800 million investment over the last decade. But all sections of accommodation have really grown over the last decade, and I think that's an important thing to note. Within your own area, you've had some guest accommodation, you've had self-catering, some glamping provision. And when I look at the actual split out, though hotels in many ways dominate by bedroom, there has been significant investment in the other areas. I would say probably in your local area, there's probably been over the last decade close to £50 million of investment, and probably likely to be more in the coming year with the news that the Slieve Donard has been sold, with an investment of £12 million underway, and I understand some further investment in some of the products that are currently in operation. The one thing that you actually have is a really strong thing, and if the person could switch forward to slide number 5, please, and the one after that, if you don't mind, yeah. You have a very authentic hotel product. You know, you have Killeavy Castle, you have the Slieve Donard, you have the Burndale, products that are, you know, very well known. Good investment, people have invested well in them, and good investment for you in terms of jobs, good investment in terms of bringing money into the council area. And it's been a market that's very much dominated by the four-star market, very popular with people coming from the south, but a market that has performed well for you. Looking at COVID-19, if the person could just switch on to the next slide, that would be great. I suppose the things that have really come about in this is rising costs, utilities, staffing, quite a number of other things, uncertainty as to when you're going to be open, when you're going to be closed, and what regulations there are. Revenue reduction throughout the course of the year. We were closed until the 24th of May and have been working under reduction, quite a number of restrictions since then. However, the summer was a real staycation success, particularly in your area where there'd be quite a number of sort of resort style properties where people did very relatively well. One of the other sides of COVID-19 is that rural destinations have proved to be very popular, so people have enjoyed coming to explore wide open spaces. The opportunities are really the continuing growth of the staycation market. Travel has been very difficult with uncertainty and ever-changing rules. Rural locations remain very popular, with people maybe looking for a slightly different holiday and looking somewhere where they haven't been before. You're lucky that you're able to have quite a diverse offering, everything from glamping through to quite luxurious hotel properties, and you also have a number of new experiences which tend to attract people as well, which is good. I suppose when I look at our sector, the biggest challenge of all has been staffing. Getting people into the market has been very difficult. In recent times, consumer confidence has really been knocked. The restoration of business has been difficult at times. Inflation and costs, I've already touched on, everything from energy to food. And we currently are looking at promotion and marketing. We've been very heavily promoted over the last year to make sure that we get people in. It's important that that continues for the coming year. Just touching on staff and skills specifically, the Federation is a member of the Hospitality and Tourism Skills Network, which is a collaborative network funded by InvestNI. They're very much looking at the attractiveness of the industry, how we engage with the staff that we have, and how we retain those in employment. There's a major careers campaign due to kick off on the 31st of January. It has been slightly delayed. It was due to go out earlier, but it has been put back owing to the fact that we're closed. There have been some liaison with stakeholders, including yourselves and the Labour Market Partnerships. And it's very important that this gets down to the grassroots level and that we have support of everybody. And also, HATS has had the opportunity to allow employers to have significant input into training content, which is important when people are going into the industry. Looking to the future, the things that we sort of need support on, VAT has been a huge advantage to us. We had a 5% VAT rate until the 30th of September, which really did help with recovery. It's currently 12.5%. We would like it to remain like that, but the understanding is it may go back up to 20% on the 1st of April. The VAT rate in the south is currently 9% and likely to remain that way until September next year. So it's a big advantage to them, and we would like our VAT rate to remain low. We've had a rates holiday for the last couple of years. We're due to have another rates holiday of 3 months in the coming year, which starts in April 2022. And given that businesses are likely to do about half their normal trading, it would be nice to see that could be continued. Our industry image is something that we are very conscious of and links into staffing. People get this idea that sometimes we're quite a low-paid industry. In actual fact, we are an industry of great opportunity that anybody can enter, and we think that's important, and we have a big part to play in that as well. Staffing, running things in the local communities and encouraging people to enter the industry and enter employment is important. A lot of talk about budgets for the moment for different departments. We would like to ensure that the tourism budget is held up. And in order to do that, we would be very keen that the tourism budget remains where it is so that we have the ability to promote in the coming year. And that's just a bit of a quick whiz through the world of hotels and tourism, and to say thank you. And if there's any questions that anybody would like to ask, I'm more than happy to answer them. And you can stop sharing the screen here. I was very kindly doing that. Thank you very much.
First of all, Janice, thank you very much. It was a very informative presentation, such a vital sector of the hospitality, especially in tourism, which is an economic, it's one of our key players in the district. You know, as I say, I welcome the, you know, your roadmap, your background of your, and especially all about how issues with COVID are affecting you at the moment, and more or less you're outlining your roadmap for the future, and your aims and aspirations all are to be welcomed. So I see the Councillor Mulcrew has in with a question, followed by Councillor McMurray. So, Roisin.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. That was very informative. And it's fantastic for us to know that we are third in the ranking, you know, in terms of hotels and overnight stays and the visitor experience. There's no doubt about it that we as a council have invested heavily in trying to make our area more attractive to visitors. And I think that has paid off for us, you know, greatly. I suppose this is like asking you how long is a piece of string. I think we as a nation are known throughout the world for our hospitality, and people come here to avail of that hospitality and to have that bit of crack with people. And, you know, certainly in terms of the offerings we have for food in particular over the last 20, 30 years has just been phenomenal. And that is backed up, as you say, by our other experiences and the quality of our hotels. You know, you've talked about the concerns that you have, you know, going forward in the future. And I would imagine that for yourselves, it's the uncertainty. You know, I talked to a number of hoteliers close to where I live myself, and they said, you know, it's the investment that they make in terms of Christmas or the wedding season or whatever. And then when the rug is pulled out, that is a huge loss of money that has already been spent. And, you know, I hope that things have turned a corner. I think it would be devastating for us as a nation if our hospitality sector was to suffer any more setbacks. And certainly if there's anything that we can do in terms of lobbying for additional support, I think it's responsibility of us all to do that. And I hope you well in the future. I know certainly close to myself there is a hotel that was on one of your slides that, you know, has seen massive personal investment. And, you know, they weren't even open. They were open months when the rug was pulled out from underneath them. And their staff are excellent. And, you know, it's a hard job. I know myself it's a hard job. But it's a very, very rewarding job. So in terms of liaison with our colleges and schools and careers advice and the assembly, we're all behind you. And I wish you as well in the future, because it is what we have become synonymous for, is our hospitality.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Rosina. And with Councillor McMurray, Andy, go ahead there.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Ms. Galt, there. Great presentation, lots of lovely photographs. You know, as you've done your homework, I think I recognised all of them, or been to all of them, apart from the golf course, but that probably says more about me than the golf course. Tell you what, you mentioned glamping pods a number of times, and I'm just wondering, sort of, within your industry, has there been any sort of, what's thinking about, you know, has there been any sort of case studies or economic reviews or studies into sort of their sustainability? Because there seems to be a big, huge increase in that market. I'm just wondering what your feeling was around the whole glamping pod industry, because it does seem good. It seems to bring people here. And I'm just curious. Thank you, Chair.
I think it's an interesting one. I think a number of hotels have actually made the decision to add on self-catering, which is what a glamping pod in many ways is. And that's something that they have decided to do. I think the idea of camping has changed significantly. And I think as one gets older, and myself included in this, I hasten to add, camping becomes less attractive. So I think that, you know, but people have had made it much more luxurious. And it's become much more a destinational thing. In some ways, it may be seen as a lesser investment. But in reality, some of the product I've seen is very, very strong and very good. I also think part of it is this in touch with nature thing. Within accommodation is a very wide gamut. You know, some people love the bed and breakfast product. Other people want a very luxurious 4-star deluxe product. And I think you've got to recognise that there are different strokes for different folks. I think certain communities really suit a glamping style product. They sort of suit the sort of the wide open doors. It can be less intrusive in some ways in areas where you maybe don't want to have a major amount of building, but you still want to experience it. In my experience, hotels recently have been looking at adding on that self-catering provision, so it is important. And I think particularly post-COVID, people are looking for an experience maybe where they can remain within a family unit in maybe what they perceive to be a more independent way. And that's something that certainly has been played into recently. I mean, there's been a lot of investment in other product in your area. You know, Hilliard House has been another thing. You know, Killeavy Castle, a massive investment. The Burndale. Most hotels have spent large amounts of money. And, you know, there's a very wide gamut of hotels. And I think that that's an important thing to note. A lot of people use hotels for very many different things, not just to stay over. They use them to come into. I mean, a number of hotels you would have would actually probably have a larger income stream in food and beverage than they would have in accommodation. But that's for the fact that they're in a town and people use them, which is great. But I think there's room for all types of accommodation. And I think the area that you have is very diverse. I mean, one thing about the figures that we get in tourism is they don't include day visitors a lot of the time, and they don't include people who come for shopping. I'm from a border town, like I'm from Derry, so everybody comes into Derry for the day, does a shop. And Newry has a bit of a similar vibe in many ways, but you are in many ways a gateway to other things, and some of the product that is beyond you is part of your attraction. And I think that's something that is important that we must remember. You know, we are, as an overall destination, we do well because we have a very diverse product.
Thanks very much, Thomas. Councillor Clark, Willie, you have a wee question.
Thanks very much, Chair. And Janice, thanks very much for your presentation. Similar to maybe with Andy, maybe, and you've discussed yourself, the great outdoors and outdoor activities is, you know, is very, very popular, particularly during COVID. And I suppose that my question is the hotel industry accommodating that change in visitors? And what I'm basically saying is, you know, like drying rooms and that type of stuff, and, you know, being able to facilitate the hotel guests. Is that discussion happening within the Hotel Federation? I'll roll out what the points are, by the way, Janice. The other points in regard to the VAT, and certainly the VAT is, reduction of VAT is a, you know, it's a huge thing for the industry. I know talking to the likes of Bob McCoubrey and that, you know, he would you know, you continuously champion reduction in that. Has the Federation had discussions in regards to keeping that reduction? And I suppose from the council point of view, all we can do is write to the Chancellor asking, you know, that the VAT reduction remains in place. Because I think I'm right, I think it's about 9% in the south.
Yeah.
So I think it's similar. I think we should have an all-island VAT on tourism, model moving forward. I'll propose we do write to the Chancellor in regards to that, that we do have a similar VAT right across the island. So I'll make that proposal. But another thing that the council is really interested in is in developing Ireland's ancient East brand. Obviously, to take in the rich cultural heritage we have in South Down, South Armagh, and indeed True Newry. You know what? Has the Federation been lobbying in regards to that particular issue? Because there seems to be a logjam in regards to expanding that. And just to finish, in regards to new hotels, obviously taking small steps type approach in regards to even looking at new hotels. But there's a number within our council area has planning permission. Just what sort of theme within the organisation is in regards to new starts. Hopefully now the pandemic is on the downward trend, and we hope that continues, and hopefully we see light at the end, and continually have to live with it, COVID-19, but hopefully start moving for the new season with a degree of optimism and confidence moving forward. The council have had grants for Killeavy is one of them. There's different grants made available for hotels or new starts within our area. Would you see that across the council areas, Janice, a similar type approach?
I will start with your first question, which is VAT. Your first question is actually in relation to outdoor activities. A number of hotels have direct relationships with outdoor companies. We have a relationship with Life One Great Adventure. We use them quite often for different things, and certainly within the hotel market, they would point people in that direction of going out and doing things in the wide out, whether it be cycling, climbing Slieve Donner, going for walks. There certainly is a relationship there. And I suppose a lot of the outdoor companies actually traditionally, as well as the sort of tourist person, would also have been very much involved in business tourism, very much involved in team building. So there is quite a strong link there. And something that we have worked on before. In answer to your other question in relation to VAT, VAT is currently set by the Treasury under EU regulations. VAT for one country really has to remain at the same level, but we understand with Brexit that could change. VAT in the south has been, there has been a reduction in tourist accommodation in the south since 1986. The first time we have actually got a reduction on any tourist activity was in July last year. The problem that we've really had is, I think the VAT reduction came in on the 15th of July. We didn't even have 365 days at the reduced VAT rate. The original rate was 5%, and then the new rate was 12.5%. I would love if it went back to 5%, but I think realistically, from our point of view, if it remained at 12.5%, people would be delighted. If it went back to 5%, people would be very keen on that. The situation in the south is theirs was 13.5%, went back to 9%, and will remain at 9% until next September, when it will be reviewed again. But from our point of view, it is one really big economic driver, and one that the customer doesn't see. No customers see that 20% of your actual income goes directly to the Treasury. The Ireland Ancient East question sort of ties in with, you know, this kind of cross-border community activity. I mean, there is the Wild Atlantic Way, there is Ireland's Ancient East, there's a waterways product. The majority of them, we also have the Causeway Coastal Route. They come from different funding sources. I don't think anybody in the hotel industry is going to argue with anything that encourages more visitors to come. Ireland's Ancient East currently stretches down as far as Cork, as far as I remember. So there is a bit of kind of a leeway and stuff like that, but those products are quite strong. And I mean, the island of Ireland has built up a very good reputation for, you know, an historical product and a product of interest. So from our point of view, that's, you know, even the St. Patrick's product in your area aligns directly with other products, aligns directly with things that are sort of in Dublin. You've different sort of ecclesiastical products that kind of join together. So we don't have any particular, we think that they're, the barriers to them tend to be that they come from different funding sources. But in reality, a lot of the product is cross-border. I mean, you're about to get some, you know, good new product in your area. There's also going to be the new Game of Thrones visitor attraction, which is just on your border. So that, from that point of view, is very strong for you as well. In relation to your new hotels piece, it really depends on what the product is. Every council and every planning authority has their own decision to make in relation to this. There are a record number of hotel bedrooms currently, and there are 145 hotels. The actual makeup of hotels has changed considerably. And, you know, 1999, your average hotel was about 30 bedrooms, was about 135 hotels. But as time has gone on, the actual hotel product has changed. And that hasn't been driven by what I think, or it's really been driven about what the customer wants. So the customer is looking for a significantly different product. And if somebody can put forward a business case for a hotel that's going to work or they feel will work, they are worth looking at on merit. I mean, Killeavy is a really good case in point, employs 120 people, a £14 million investment, very, very much the vision of one person. And quite often those visionary products are the products that get across the line. Hoteliers by nature and people who develop them tend to be pretty stoic. And they are very keen to invest in areas. And most of them will be prepared to put significant amounts of their own money in. And I think for you as a council and for a council area, that's a good thing. There are a number of projects in your area at this moment in time, some in common knowledge, others perhaps not. Generally, by rule of thumb, about 30% of projects that are originally mooted kind of move forward. And that's just because people come up with different ideas. And sometimes things start off as one thing and end up as something completely different. And I think that's something that's happened in the past as well. But I think that there is room for accommodation product in most areas. And certainly if it's developed sympathetically and with the support of both the local population and the local council, it can do very well for everybody.
Thanks very much, Janice. I see we're listening from Councillor McAteer. Dak, can go ahead there. Thank you.
Interesting. Janice, thank you for the presentation. Just a couple of wee things. Well, first of all, you did touch on there. I'm just trying to figure, you know, would you see there is room for more hotel expansion, you know, especially along our coastal areas, you know, given the, you know, given the length of the coastline we have, and actually some quite undiscovered areas in it, and I'm not excluding the potential for a geopark as well, extend obviously into South Armagh. So I was just wondering, is there an appetite for that, or does the industry feel that the threshold hasn't been met yet in terms of spend to justify and encourage that? You know, the other week question too again is, how is staffing? I mean, the message I'm getting from some hotel owners is that staffing, especially chefs, it's a major issue, and the issue of cross border workers is a problem as well. I'm talking about the fellow Europeans coming in. So I wonder how much is it impacting, or do you think that'll impact in the future? And finally, in terms of destination food quality and provenance, how big a part is that playing in the new modern industry?
The first question is a difficult one. I mean, hotel development is something that does take place. I mean, the majority of the hotel development over the last 10 years has really been concentrated in particular areas. And it is one of those things that kind of comes along. It is about really what's there and what's the last mile and how do you get there. And if you have a product that people really want to visit or that you market well, it will work provided it's the right product in the right place. You know, you have a lot of people who are existing hoteliers in your area who have developed their product and expanded it. And sometimes that can be a very good investment for them. You know, new hotels are something that lots of people look at a lot of the time. And hotels are not a short investment. They're a 30-year, you know, they're a 30-year investment at the earliest. And in reality, the day you finish building your hotel, it's probably worth less than it was from the sum of the whole investment. So that's, I think, something to be aware of. A lot of this really depends on how we fare as a sort of a destination in the future. And we've seen a lot of growth over the last probably 5 to 6 years. We unusually, unlike other destinations, we had very little organic growth for about 6 years, which is a very unusual thing. There is a saying, in times of peace, plan for war. And certainly at the moment, a lot of people are very interested in investing in the hotel and tourism market, just as airlines have proved very popular with the share and shares. It's a similar thing. People think that there will be a significant bounce. And I do think that there will be a bounce throughout the island. I think Ireland as a destination has performed very well. People see it as a safe destination. It's been in the news for the right reason. And certainly we have reached out as an industry and made people, kept us people in the mind's eye. I sit on a board in North America and the interest in coming to Ireland is huge. People think that it's still on their bucket list. They still want to come here. The one thing that I think is a real curtailment is staffing. And I think that staffing, you know, since I joined the Federation, which is quite a while ago, chefs have always been mentioned. Chefs have been mentioned throughout the world as a shortage, but that shortage has sort of spread into other areas, spread into supervisory roles, housekeeping, food and beverage. And we understand we have a piece of work to do on that as well. We understand that it's quite important. The two things that I would say about this is, we have skills that other people find very appealing and therefore they're keen to poach staff once they're trained out of our sector. And secondly, we have a job of work to do to make the attractiveness of our sector, you know, we need to get that message out there. But staffing is the one thing that really can curtail things and make it difficult. Your question about Europeans is an issue. We traditionally would have had people would have come here from Europe throughout all aspects of the business, and they have simply stopped. So we've had several cases where maybe somebody worked in Ballinscanlan, wanted to come over to Killeavy, wasn't able to do so because when it transpired, they actually weren't an Irish national, so they couldn't travel over. And that is an issue, and that's an immigration policy issue. We have asked that certain things be changed in terms of policy so that we are able to sort of say, you know, we are an industry that needs to have certain provision made and visas need to be put in place. The current policy is about 23,000, I think, is the minimum level you come in. The process itself is at best tortuous. I mean, it really, if you're a small business, you just wouldn't even start down it. We hope, I think there has been a little bit of movement on it and we would like to see that continue to grow. On your subject of food, I mean, food is, you know, food is one of those things that, and it, this is a sort of more a comment. We have excellent food. Our food is very good. We've brilliant ingredients. We've loads of food production companies, north and south. We tend to take our food for granted in many ways. We kind of think, oh, you know, we've great cream. We've great, you know, we've great home produce. We're having this discussion about steak, you know. All our meat is grass-fed. We don't think there's anything unusual about that. In America, grass-fed beef carries about a 40% premium. I think we've got used to having good food, and maybe we are slightly conservative in what we eat as well, but that's, you know, that is the nature of the nature of the beast. I think food is becoming increasingly important, and the one thing I will say is people may not come to this destination for their food, but when they return from here, it's one thing they generally comment on, that the food has been very good. And I think food, like a lot of other things, is on a bit of a journey. We're currently in the middle of Vegan January. Slight bit of a challenge for those of us who aren't vegans. But, you know, food has changed very considerably over the last number of years. You know, we are very lucky. We have a very good, clean, agricultural-based business, good meat, good food, tradition of good bait products. And I think that's something we should be very proud of. And it has been used as a hook in the past. We did have a year of food and drink. It was very successful. And it would be nice to see that being brought back again. Pre-pandemic, there was sort of like a month or 6 week food promotion. I think that will come back again. And I think that's something that we can certainly use as a promotional tool.
That's great. Thanks for those answers.
Thanks so much. That's with Councillor Savage.
Hello, Chair. My question wasn't appearing on the dialogue there, so didn't know whether you'd saw me or not. Jonas, thanks for a superb presentation, as always, and for your detailed insight into the whole industry. Just when you touch on food there, probably the only question that I would have, most of the bases have all been covered by my councillor colleagues. It is really in relation to the challenges in relation to cost for food at the moment. And I know that a lot of hoteliers that I've been speaking to, and obviously those within the hospitality industry, are having a real struggle to keep their menus at affordable levels for so many reasons. And I can see, you know, certainly in some of the places, some of us who were sort of hibernating for a period of time and come out, saw a significant increase, even despite the VAT level being at a low ebb. You know, is that a challenge for the way forward to make it, you know, cost effective within restaurants to attract that footfall? And I'm talking about, you know, the sort of ambulance trade that you would get within the, you know, the localities that hotels are there. For example, if you take the Canal Court there, the local footfall it would get for its restaurant and bar, you know, all those sort of staple incomes that come into those organizations and businesses that are beyond just the bed nights and the tourist product. You know, is that a challenge you see for the foreseeable? And, you know, how does that, coupled with staff shortages, does it create a potential perfect storm that you have to deal with in the short term till Brexit in some form or other sorted?
I think that currently, I think inflation, there is a definite upturn in inflation, which the economists said is going to be a short-term thing. I have found generally when prices go up, they very rarely go down, but that's just maybe a more a woman thing than a sort of like an observational thing. There are three aspects to food. It's certainly costing you more to buy it, which is, you know, your food content has gone up. You know, your food content has quite considerably risen. It's costing you more to actually prepare it because energy costs have gone up in some cases by up to 35%, and it's costing you more to serve it. So those three aspects in the short term, I do not see changing. I think the difference is, in many ways, people have realized you have to make a profit in order to continue to invest. You know, we had food that was significantly cheap. It was, you know, we were a relatively inexpensive destination in many ways, but with the kind of rise in all three aspects of it, it's been very difficult to balance that. And I suppose the last part of that is also the sustainability and the continuation of supply. Brexit, in some ways, has changed the supply of goods. So people have maybe had to be much more nimble on their menu. You know, you may have previously had 25 items on your menu. You might have had to reduce that. You've less staff to cook it. Your supplier may be facing challenges. I mean, your challenges around cheese, olive oil, I think that those are things that are a challenge. But the other side of that is people themselves have probably been paid more because wage inflation has taken place across all aspects of society in general. Our wages have certainly gone up. I mean, minimum wage will go up now in the start of April, but most people's salaries have gone up because there is wage inflation. So you do find yourself in this sort of perfect storm of it's costing you more to buy it, costing you more to prepare it, and costing you more to serve it. And that is definitely, but I think that will have an impact globally, not just in Ireland, and certainly not just in your council area.
Thanks for that, John.
Thank you.
Thanks. Roisin, you seconded Councillor Willie Clark's proposal to make the transfer regard VAT reduction. So are members happy with the proposal that's been tabled this evening? I take it members are happy enough. So again, Janice, thank you very much for coming along. It was a very, very interesting presentation, and also to members for their contributions also. So thanks again. So with that agenda item being dealt with, we now move on to item number four, the paper, and that's the action sheets from our last meeting. So what we'll do is we'll ask for proposer and seconder, please. So proposed by Councillor Dermot Curran in the chamber, and Councillor Mulgrew in the chamber as well. Thank you very much, and thanks to the ones online who offered to propose. So we'll go to page one. Page two, page three, page four, page five, and page six. Are there any banners arising out of the action sheets that members would like to raise? I think members are happy enough for that. Thanks so much. Now, we move on now to agenda and item number 5 in our paper, and it's the notice of motion from Councillor Patrick Brown. So, Patrick, if you're there, you're very welcome to speak on your motion. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much, Terry. Cheers for that. I assume everyone's read the officer's report there. I've also obviously reviewed it. And you know, essentially, it's recommending not to proceed with the motion as it was presented. And I did have a chat with Gary McCurry about this, and I do appreciate where he's coming from on it. And I'll touch on some of those reasons in a moment. I do want to make a point. Surely that if a councillor proposes and seconds a motion at full council, it should, I think, be put forward for decision at committee, and this report is for noting currently, regardless of whether the officer's report leans in favour or against it. And I would say that that sets somewhat worrying precedent of notices of motion potentially being watered down or bypassed and put up just for noting, so that decisions on them aren't actually made. You know, I think that's worrying given that notices of motion are one of the few ways that councillors can ensure proposals that they make are binding on the council. So I just wanted to flag that up. But that being said, I do take on board fully that the points that are made in the officer's report and the challenges facing the proposal to give free parking to EV owners. And I appreciate the time and effort as well that has gone into the report in order to give councillors the chance to make an educated and informed decision on this. I would challenge one of the points in the report that it would be difficult or time consuming to identify electric cars, as I think most, if not all, could be easily identified if parking attendants had a list of makes and models to cross-reference. You know, it wouldn't involve inspecting the drive chain or anything like that, as the report suggests. And look, the points that the report makes around the need for central government to drive electric vehicle take up, pun intended there, is very accurate, and fully accept that council shouldn't be the only one in the driving seat on this. However, that does not let local government off the hook on this. The fact is that this motion and a related one from Councillor Enright came about recently because of the poor EV charging network right across the district, and the fact that council, as the body responsible for most car parking across the district, should be doing more around this. So whilst I welcome the comments at the end of the report that council continues to work collaboratively on funding for EV charging points, as councillors, I do think we need to see some figures around this. Maybe officers, if there's any present, call them. I don't know if you're on the call, and maybe officers can answer now. You know, how many EV charging points are there in council car parks currently? And I think that would be a useful exercise to try and benchmark against how many EV charging points are in other council areas with similar geographies to ours, and see how we compare as a council in that. I would make that a request. I know I can't make a proposal as a non-committee member, but is that something that perhaps officers could do and bring back to a future committee? Thanks, Chair.
You want to come in, Connor?
Yes, thanks, Chair. Just in response to Councillor Brown's points made around the purpose of the report prepared by the officials, just to provide clarity, the report is provided as information to allow the debate to continue and to allow a decision to be made by the committee on whether to agree with the motion or not. So a decision is totally a matter for the members of the committee based on the information that they have, including the presentation from the councillor who's moving the motion and the debate that ensues thereafter. So the report is for information only. That's why it's referred to as being for noting, and the decision on the motion still can happen tonight at the committee.
Thanks very much, Conor. Colin Jackson, please.
Thank you, Chair. I was going to take you through the report, but as Councillor Brown has alluded to there, he has gone through the report himself, so I don't think there's any need for myself to do so. You've just raised the point in relation to how many charge points we have in our car parks at the minute, and to the best of my knowledge, I think we've got 8 charge points in our car parks at the minute. There's a proposal going forward for a further 15 to be established in the district in the short term. But the positions of those have yet to be agreed. But there would be, you know, we're looking at an additional 15 to be rolled out shortly.
Thanks very much, Colette. And several councillors have indicated that they'd like to speak. And the first councillor would be Councillor Hannah, and then Councillor Savage. I noticed you had your hand up, so I'll take Councillor Glenn Hannah first, then Councillor Savage, and then Councillor Mulgrew and Councillor Clark. And if any other members want to contribute to the debate, they're more than welcome. Thank you. So it's over to yourself, Glenn.
Thanks, Chair. A couple of questions there for Conor and Colin. Could you just clear it up with me? I was in reading the report, and that we should not be discriminating against any particular person or vehicle or anything like that there. Is it clear that we cannot make a difference between electric vehicles and ordinary petrol diesel vehicles? Just everybody should be charged. We should not be making any preference towards anybody. The second question is, possibly, I don't know if Conor would know or Colin, how much does it actually cost the council to charge a vehicle for an hour and a half or 2 hours? Are you talking about a lot of pennies, or are you talking about a lot of money on that there? Just the proposed charges for the car parks that we are charging at the moment, does that not go directly for repairs to the upkeep of the car parks? And just a comment from myself, anybody who's buying an electric vehicle, electric vehicles are some of the most expensive vehicles on the road at the moment. To give them free car park, and I don't actually think it would be much of an incentive for people to buy electric vehicles. And 40p, I don't know much it is an hour down there. We fortunately up at this end of the council don't pay for car parking. So I don't actually think 40p or whatever it is they're going to save there for an hour's car parking is going to make a big lot of difference. And my thoughts are that the council is actually, I know we're taking a lead on it, we're going to provide these parking or these charging points on hand, or at some stage maybe Conor or Colum's going to have to tell somebody that why should the council and the ratepayers be paying to charge these vehicles up free of charge to the people that can afford to buy the most expensive cars on the road for the average man? So a few questions here. I hope either Conor or Colin would be able to answer them for me. Thank you.
Go ahead, Colin.
Sure, I'm happy to come in there. In relation to the charge to the council at the minute for the cost to us for actually charging the electric vehicles up, there is no charge. Those costs are free at present. Now, I'm sure as the infrastructure rolls out in the future, I'm sure that, you know, there will be charges applied to those. It's like everything else. It's offered free at the minute to incentivize people to purchase the vehicles, but I guarantee that in the future there will be some sort of charge. And those details have not been addressed yet at this stage as to how much it's going to cost and how that is going to be operated. I'm sure the private operators will come in, manage those facilities, manage the machines themselves, and actually charge a tariff for charging up the vehicle. So I'm sure that will happen in the future. As far as you mentioned, we charge the public 40 pence per hour in 11 of our car parks out of the total car parks that we have. And the 40 pence per hour, basically that goes on the maintenance costs, the upkeep, the tarmac and the lighting, the white lines, all that type of thing. But also the electricity for the street lighting, the enforcement costs and the cleaning. So that's what your 40 pence per hour, is used for. And the 11 car parks that we charge for, we spread that out over all of the car parks, and the car parks that we inherited from DFI, there are over 30 car parks in that category. There are only 11 of them that are charged. So the 11 subsidise the maintenance cost for the remainder. So I think I hope that has answered your question, Glenn.
Could I just highlight one point to everybody, all the councillors? On an average car, you're getting about 10 miles to the litre CR. The average hybrid car on a charge will do 60 miles to the well on that. So if you work it out something like at £1.30 even per litre for every 10 miles, so we're actually giving those people, so we are. £7-8 or that's what the council's actually given to them. If 60 miles is roughly what you'll get out of a charge, a full charge at a car park. So if you divide that into the average car there, that gets 10 miles to the litre. So you'll actually give them £7-8 here. And, you know, to be quite honest with you, I think the council's been very generous and the ratepayers have been very generous to these people. So that's my thoughts on it. Would you agree with that, Connor, what I'm trying to say there?
No comment.
Well, I believe I'm right there, because 60 miles is what you get in a hybrid car roughly out of a charge. 10 miles to the litre of fuel, a diesel or a petrol is about what you get. So if you work that out quite simply, so that is, you're getting £6 or £7 worth of free electricity every time you charge at a council charging point. So that's my comments. Thanks, Chair.
Okay, thanks, Glenn. I will move on to Councillor Savage, and then we'll have Councillor Mulgrew and Councillor Clark after that. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, Chair, I think maybe Glenn has raised in some of the issues that we need to take on board of this, and I fully understand the sentiment behind what Paddy was advocating here. We all want to get all our population, if possible, into green vehicles that protect our planet. But we have to do it in a way that I believe there's a social justice element to it. Because I have concerns that, as Glenn has pointed out, that these vehicles at the moment are way, way, way beyond the reach of the ordinary man and woman in the street and the ordinary families here. And I have concerns with people with disabilities, accessibility to car parking, and I think those people should be the people that we are giving our priority to in relation to anything that we do in relation to supporting our local community in relation to accessibility to car parks. That said, I fully support the transformation of our fleet across these islands and across the globe from fossil fuels to new greener energy and to electric vehicles as soon as possible. The challenge really is to the industry and to governments that they make this as affordable as possible to the vast majority of the population. And I would be just concerned that we would be seen at the moment to be, you know, advocating support for people who can fundamentally support, are prepared and quite within their means to pay for quite expensive vehicles. And I think that 40 pence an hour isn't something that's going to break them at the moment. I think the big challenge for the council and for government, and I know that the infrastructure minister and other government departments are working hard to try and ensure that we roll out this infrastructure. That should be our major move at the minute, is to play our role as a council in making this form of green transport as much accessible to people as possible from all backgrounds and from all demographics. I feel at the moment, because we haven't seen the second-hand trade in these vehicles start to filter down, that at the moment it's only those in high incomes or with expendable income are able to access these, with the exception potentially of those people who are on mobility schemes, and rightfully so, because of disabilities can potentially access them. But I think there's an awful lot more work to do than this beyond looking at charging and are not charging for car parking where these sites are. I don't think we have enough of them at the moment, and I think what we need to do is to create the demand or meet the demand that could potentially be out there, make sure that we develop enough of these across our district, and then we use potential incentives if we feel that they're required to encourage people to use them. But I have big concerns about people in low incomes getting access to these vehicles, and I think the industry and governments have a lot to do, and I think we should be playing a role to make sure that decisions we make don't discriminate against anybody in our society. But in relation to the ethos of what Paddy's advocating, yes, I support the sentiments of what he's saying, but I also see very strong merits in what's come through from Colley's paper.
Thanks very much, Councillor Savage. Councillor McGrew, Roisin?
Yeah, thank you very much, Chair. I, like previous speakers, I don't know why I'm screeching here in the chamber. I, like previous speakers, understand where Councillor Brown was coming from with his motion. But I would be much more inclined to accept the recommendations of the officers. I think it's only really in the last couple of years that the world has become really serious about renewable energy. I mean, really, really serious. And I think we are going to see that technology moving very, very quickly. And I'm not so sure that the future of green vehicles is going to be solely electric. I actually think that may, you know, become while part of the region of green fleet, I think it could be replaced with other new technology. And I think it's up to governments to try and you know, look at how we move forward. I would like to see a situation where this really central government continue to take the lead in this. And I would envisage that this will become an issue for planning in the future. Like over the last number of years, we've seen the need for all facilities and dwellings to be designed in a way that they can be used by people of all abilities. I actually think that we need central government to look at planning applications coming in, that homes will automatically have a recharging point, you know, that developments, places of employment, all of that sort of thing, that the facilities for renewable energies and green vehicles would be part of a planning application. It may also be a case that the forecourt may just change the type of fuel that is dispensed from them. So I totally accept that Councillor Brown was coming from a good position, but I do take on board what the officers are saying. And this is about treating everybody the same. But I think we do need to continue to put pressure on central government to really, you know, they've made a commitment and it's up to them to produce the goods. But I imagine that this is going to roll very, very quickly. And I wouldn't be 100% sure that electric will be the be-all and end-all. But we need to be looking at all options. So I would be happy to accept the officer's report.
Thanks, Councillor McGrew. And then are you making out a proposal?
Yes, I would be happy that we accept the officer's report.
Thank you very much, Roisin. And then I say with Councillor Clark for a comment. Go ahead, Willie.
Yeah, Chair, thanks very much. And I'm happy, or I see Michael second, that's fair enough. I think the previous speakers have outlined basically what I would say as well. I think it's electric charging points right across the district is what's required moving forward. And it's about central government, you know, working with ourselves. And I'm not even saying about the current minister, you know, right back to 2008, I remember being in the Assembly talking in regards to this issue and about climate change, and there was a reluctance in the Assembly even to take it serious. At that time, there was the Environment Minister, I don't mention who they were, but they didn't take it seriously at all, and we are playing catch-up, I believe. And the Council and true councillors and officers, you know, we are trying to close that gap as best we can, but we certainly need the support of the central government to enable us to do it. I agree about the social justice aspect. The vast majority of the people who are buying electric cars at the minute, you know, are on a good disposable income compared to the people who can hardly afford a car, basically. And we look at the energy prices that people are facing. People are finding it very hard to, you know, put fuel in their cars. So if there's any sort of incentive needed, it's that. The fuel prices will continually be outside our control. And we have to find sustainable solutions to protect our constituents moving forward. And we talk about, electric charging. But we also have to remember, how are we producing our electric? You know, how is this electric being produced? Is it being produced through fossil fuels? And then we're, charging our cars with it. So there's a number of issues there, and I appreciate Paddy's motion is trying to, you know, keep the momentum going in regards to it. I do appreciate that, but I agree with the officers. The more cars that are electrified, the reduction of income would have severe consequences for ourselves moving forward. So I think the best thing we can do is to make it affordable for the class, all classes moving forward, that the people who are living in the housing estates, that they have equal opportunities to get an electric car, be that through grants, scrappage schemes, or indeed the interest-free loans for residents, where they're making a saving. If you've got an interest-free loan, for example, you're making a saving on the charging of your vehicle. The savings you're making from fossil fuels could be used to pay back that interest-free loan. So they're the type of initiatives that we need moving forward. And I agree with Roisin also that there's different technologies. And when you see the fossil industries moving into looking at hydrogen fuel cells, you can be sure that that's definitely going to be one option moving forward, along with hybrid models and cars being able to charge themselves. So I do agree with what the officer's saying. I don't think this will be an incentive because the vast majority of people can't afford electric vehicles. That's the fact. Thanks, Chair.
Hey, welcome, Councillor Clark. And then over to Henry, Councillor Riley.
Thanks very much. Yeah. Just to point out that if all the vehicles in this area went electric by 2030, as the UK government's proposing, the electricity infrastructure couldn't handle it. And I've been aware of industrial units that have been proposed that are being NIE are questioning whether they will be able to supply it. So we're already in a critical position regarding electricity supply throughout Southdown, and particularly in the Mourns area. And I have already pointed out to the council that hydrogen, especially for HGVs, is the only real alternative option. And JCB, Toyota, Ineos, there's a number of big organisations are going down that road now, and that will be available to us. So putting too high a degree of emphasis on electric cars might not be the best way forward at the present time until we get a bigger overview of what the infrastructure needs are going to be in terms of electricity supply and what alternatives are going to be available. And they seem to be coming pretty soon, so in terms of hydrogen. So we should just be careful on this. And I think the officers have brought forward a fairly balanced reply or report. I'm happy to accept that. Thank you, Chairman.
Thanks very much, Councillor Reddy. And we have Councillor Hanlon for a comment.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. No, I'm not a member of this committee. I just wanted to maybe make the point within the officer's report that there's only one car park at the minute that actually is a charging car park and has an electric charging point in it. So ultimately, I suppose the motion's quite flawed because it's proposing something that isn't really in existence or making a big impact at the minute. Of course, we should be moving towards a greener society and encouraging electrification, but it might be maybe more of a proposal, which I can't make in this committee, but to look at where we're actually going to place the new ones in the future, that they don't maybe go into a charging car park, that they are put somewhere where the people can park for free. So we're looking at it in the round, the other way about.
Thanks so much, Luna, for your contribution. And see Councillor Burgess has a wee comment to make. Go ahead, Robert.
Yes, Chair. I too would be feeling of all our councillors there. To allow a car at 50, 60, maybe even 100,000, it was sitting parked for nothing, and someone who a car worth £500 coming in and have to pay in for parking, I think he's going the wrong road about it. And to be honest, if he really wants to help the planet, I think you should be encouraging people to get out of their cars and on their bikes. And not only would it save the energy costs to someone that would actually keep them fit, because you want to see someone getting out of the electric cars here in Sinfield. I'm telling you that now. It's unreal, you know, and the cost. And I think maybe the government's trying to pull a fast one on us here and encourage more electric vehicles, electric cars. The next thing they're going to say, okay, we can't get the energy here. We'll need to build another couple of nuclear power stations. Maybe that's the road they're on. And you know where they're going to build them? They're going to build them on the west coast of GB. And you know the problem that we had with Sellafield. So really, I don't think, Paddy, you're on the right track this time.
Thanks very much, Councillor Burgess. And I would like to thank members for their contributions to the motion. And I now hand over to Councillor Brown to sum up. All right, Patrick, thank you.
Thanks, Terry, and appreciate the light pun there at the end, Robert, on the right track. But look, I do appreciate the comments made, and as I've said, the officers have produced a well-balanced report, which I do appreciate, and you know has pointed to perhaps the correct way forward on this. Just to briefly touch on some of the points raised, you know, I do think on Glyn's point, we should still be encouraging free charging for electric vehicles in order to incentivize ownership. Maybe when ownership goes out, we look at trying to phase that out and start charging for it. But I do think at the moment, it's very important that we do that and that we expand that free charging network as well. Henry absolutely raises a good point about the need for greater investment in grid infrastructure. And that's going to be integral if we're going to properly support EV ownership down the line. And just on Una's point, you know, the motion wasn't tied to the availability of charging points. It was to incentivize electric vehicle ownership by giving them free parking anywhere. But as you know, I've made clear, I have conceded on that point as a result of Chatham officers and seeing their report. Just in terms of the new charging stations that we're looking to bring in, 15 is of course more than welcomed. But as I think, you know, Una said, there's only one working in her area in the Downpatrick DEA anyway, and there is others across the district, I think. But that's the only one that I'm aware of, you know, locally. I don't think 15 is enough in terms of the size of the district. I think we should be aiming for more, but I think it would be useful to start off by doing that benchmarking exercise with other council areas. So I would again make the request that council officers go away and look at that if possible. But look, thanks everyone for their comments and the debate.
Thanks very much, Patrick, for your summing up and you're happy enough then to go ahead with the recommendations laid out in tonight's paper.
Yeah, that's grand, sorry.
Thanks, Patrick. Okay, members, thanks very much for your contributions. It was a very interesting topic, and we'll now move on to our next agenda.
Just before you go on there, can I ask one more question about it?
Thanks, Robert, we'll wrap up.
Tell Connor, the charging points, when they break down, who actually can charge affection them? Because I've seen one or two of them sitting lately where, not in our district, but where they were out of action. Who actually maintains those, or who fixes them if we put them in?
Yeah, I think, Chair, I can maybe provide you with some sort of response. I know they're not operated by council. They would be a lot of private providers. And I think ESB and NIE were at one stage tasked with putting a lot of these EV charging locations in, and they would have the responsibility for going out and carrying out any repairs. And there is a lot of reports of EV charging points not working and haven't been working for some time. But I think there has been a bit of activity over the last lot of months on the back of the publicity around the lack of charging points, and a lot more have come online. But it's the responsibility of the provider, and it's normally the electricity company that provides them.
So there's no hope of them ever coming back to council, and council, how do you start and maintain them?
I'm not in a position to sort of try and predict into the future around whether we will inherit existing electric vehicle charging points or not, but I wouldn't have thought so.
Thanks for that, Chair. Sorry about that, button in.
You're fine, Robert. Okay, Connor, thank you very much. We're now moving on to the agenda item number 6 in the paper, and it's the All-Ireland Smart Cities Forum. So I'll hand over to Jonathan to give us a report on the contents of the paper. Thank you.
Okay, Chair, you have a paper in front of you this evening to give you some background and update on the All-Ireland Smart Cities Forum. This is a body that we sit on through East Border Region along with Dublin, Cork, Limerick, Waterford, Galway, Derry, Belfast and obviously ourselves. Really the purpose is a collaborative arrangement to look at how, I suppose from our perspective, how other cities have utilised their smart infrastructures and technologies to develop the city centres. That's very much a learning process, Chair. We've updated there how the partnership is starting to look at a strategy moving forward and how it could be funded and become more proactive in the future. Chair, the recommendation is that we remain as a member of the forum and to note the progress to date. The cost of remaining a member is €4,800 per annum, Chair.
Thanks very much, Jonathan. And I see we've got Councillor Stokes, who's proposed, and Councillor Curran in the chamber, who has seconded the recommendations and on the All Ireland Smart Cities Forum. So thanks very much. Members happy enough in agreement? Yes, people are happy enough. Thanks very much. We're now on to number 7 in our order paper, and it's the BRC Renewed Ambition Programme. So we'll hand over again to Jonathan to give us another update. Jonathan, thank you.
Chair, this is an initiative that is developed out of the Belfast Region City Day work, Chair, and it's around the opportunity to work collaboratively to showcase the entire region for both investment and development opportunities, Chair. You would have recalled we would have previously engaged on the MIPIM in property development opportunities and done so remotely this year through development of other avenues through social media, Chair. We are planning to, or exploring the opportunity to develop a programme for 2022, and the request is that the Council contribute £15,000 towards this initiative along with each of the other partners to develop a programme of continued collaboration, promotion and advocacy for the region for investment and development opportunities.
Thanks very much, Jonathan. And I see it's been proposed by Councillor Mulgrew and also seconded by Councillor Guy Stokes. And Councillor McMurray, you've been a wee queue for a question, so go ahead, Andy. Thank you.
Yeah, Chair, no, not against the item per se, but again, just reading it, just what regulations, given the element of both public and international elements as noted in the report, are envisaged regarding the potential investment with in property real estate. I'm just sort of, you know, whether it be London or Dublin, there are drawbacks, both economic and social, to unfettered foreign investment into our real estate markets. And again, I'm just curious to sort of delve into that point. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, that would really be for the developers. What we're doing is bringing the opportunities to market and making them aware of making the market aware of the opportunities that exist in our area for investment and development. I suppose the legalities around that and how that works is a whole other avenue. But what we're doing is really signposting our area and advocating for the area.
Thanks very much, Andy. You happy enough? Andy's on mute. That's okay. We'll move on then. Members in agreement? Thanks very much. And we'll now move on to agenda item number 8, which is the Small Settlement Regeneration Plan. So again, Jonathan, it's over to yourself.
Yeah. Chair, this item would have been tabled at our last month's meeting, and it's a very fast moving development, Chair. We were received formal communication from the department on the 13th of December, and they were seeking bids for the 21st of December. So, Chair, basically what is presented this evening is a summary of the bid that was submitted for £3 million investment across the district to look at our smaller settlements, those settlements below the population of 5,000, which would have previously wouldn't have availed of DEFC funds. So this programme has been put together between DEFC, DERA and DFA. We've outlined the broad parameters of the programme, and what has been proposed initially is around shopfront streetscape scheme and a number of public realm schemes, and we've identified a number of key areas, Chair. What we're seeking approval this evening is to progress with the procurement that may be needed around the design element of the scheme, and in parallel with this, take the funding proposal through to the DES for further discussion, as part of the submission does require wider stakeholder engagement. We have developed these initiatives based on research that would have been carried out previously. Chair, but this evening there is an opportunity just to get you updated, seek approval to keep the programme going with further detail to come back following consultation through the DES.
Thanks very much, Alan, for your wee report there. So, Councillor Burgess, you've been for a proposal, but you see you've got a wee comment beside the page, so go ahead, Robert.
Yes, Chair, I would be prepared to make a proposal that we take the officer's recommendation, but in saying that, the shop fronts and sweep kit enhancement scheme for Dundrum, Newton Hamilton, Hanalong, Meighen, Stankford, and Hilltown, and Killaloe. Killaloe is a much needed area. Like, you only have to look at some of the shops that and tidy up is what is actually needed. And it's good to see that at all those are going to get that support. And also the regeneration, the environmental improvement scheme for Bessbrook, Castle Allen and Ross Driver, and especially Shanefield. Those are all sitting there ready to go. And hopefully that'll all come to fruition. And yep, I'm making that proposal, Chair, to accept the officer's recommendation. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Robert. And Councillor Guy Stokes, I see he is seconded. And Patrick, you have a wee comment, so you're very welcome. Go ahead, Patrick. Public, you're good. Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's grand. Just to echo Councillor Burgess's comments there and put my oar in for Killaloe. I was actually on a walk around with the Community Association this morning, and they are ready to really take advantage of this fund, particularly in terms of potential shop fronts. I think there's a real opportunity there to add massive amounts of value to Killaloe High Street in particular, and it really is a low-hanging fruit that could transform the village. Also want to add my support for trying to widen out footpaths and add some cycle routes around Killaloe, and particularly between Killaloe and Downpatrick. Those routes are increasingly used by both walkers and cyclists, in particular around the Coil as well, for example. So I know it's focusing mainly on inner town and village projects, but I want to make sure that the rural areas connecting them are not left behind as well, and we're still continuing to promote the active travel in rural areas too. Thank you very much for indulging me, Chair.
You're more than welcome, Patrick. And I see Councillor Jarlath Tilney. Jarlath, go ahead. You're very welcome. I know you're non-member, but you're very welcome to have a wee...
Thanks, Terry. Thank you. No, I just want to concur with the previous speakers there in relation to the importance of these schemes. And give particular thanks to Connor and Jonathan for bringing it to this point, particularly the EA proposals, something I've been lobbying for quite a few years from my own village. In some places, Terry, it's like a patchwork quilt, and the last EA scheme was 20 years ago, so it's badly dated and badly needs a makeover. So I'm very grateful to see this is moving in the right direction. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jonathan. And then wrapping up here, are members happy enough to go ahead based on the proposal by Councillor Burgess and seconded by Councillor Stokes? And just before we do go to the decision, I'd just like to, I'm just setting my vice chair's hat aside for temporarily for a second or two, just to welcome the paper, all the hard work that's gone into it, and it's a good news story for the settlements that have been listed in the paperwork, and to the officers involved, a job well done. And again, thanks so much. So, with members have been happy with that paper, we now move on to in committee items now. So the following items were going to be taken in closed session, which will be item 9 for the Castlewell and Forest Park operating module procurement. Item 10 will be Labour Market Partnership. Item 11 will be Newcastle Harbour Sale and Economy pilot proposal. Sorry. Item 12 will be the Planning IT system. Item number 13 will be Shared Environmental Services, LDP, SLA, and item 14 will be the Tourism NI products. So the items that I have listed are read out. Items 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 and 14 are deemed to be exempt under paragraph 3 of the part 1 of the Schedule 6 of the Local Government Northern Ireland Act 2014. Information relating to the financial or business affairs of any particular person, including the Council holding that information and the public, may by resolution be excluded during these items of business. So I'm going to call for a proposer and second. I see Councillor Dermot Kern has proposed that we go into committee.
Yeah, happy to second.
And Councillor McGrew in the chamber also is happy to second. Sorry.
Go ahead, Terry.
Very much. And in relation to, on your order paper, in relation to items 15 to 20 inclusive for noting, if members have any queries or questions in relation to those individual papers, please contact the officers who will only be too glad to provide you with answers to your questions. So I have to read out the paper as follows. On the following that was agreed during closed session, the following, from agenda item number 9, Castlewell and Forest Park operating module procurements. On a proposal of Councillor Dermot Curran, seconded by Councillor Andrew McMurray, it was agreed, number one, to award two number trading pinches at Castlewell and Forest Park under the terms detailed in the report. Point two, to appoint a co-source grass and hedge cutting services for a 3-year period via public procurement. Point three, to appoint a suitably experienced and certified specialist maintenance contractor for a 3-year period via a public procurement. Item number 10 on the paper is the Labour Market Partnership. On the proposal of Councillor Gary Stokes, seconded by Councillor Roisin Mulgrew, it was agreed the following. Councillor issue a service level agreement to Southern Regional College and also to South Eastern Regional College to create an apprenticeships awareness campaign across the district, delivering against the Labour Market Partnership Action Plan. Council issue a service level agreement to Newry and Mourne Enterprise Agency and Down Business Centre to implement the LMP action, stimulate self-employment as an employment opportunity, offering follow-on support to their go-for-it clients. And council issue a service level agreement to Department for Communities or an appropriate partner if DFC cannot fulfil within the timescales to implement the delivery of a virtual jobs fair during 21-22 year. It was also agreed to note that Council have received and accepted a letter of offer from Department for Communities for implementation of LMP actions between January 22 and March 2022. The report above outlines the anticipated actions that can be implemented within this timescale. Council will commence engagement regarding the submission of a further action plan outlining LMP actions for 22-23 and which is due to be submitted to the Department for Communities in February 22. Item number 11 is Newcastle Harbour Provision of Services. On the proposal of Councillor Willie Clark, seconded by Councillor Gary Stokes, it was agreed to approve a pilot programme for a sailing academy to operate from Newcastle Harbour from April to October 22, subject to the conditions set out in the report. Item number 12, planning IT system. On a proposal of Councillor Gary Stokes, seconded by Councillor Roisin Mulgrew, it was agreed to approve the service level agreement and associated costs of the shared service for the new planning system. Item number 13 is the Shared Environmental Services, LDP SLA. On the proposal of Councillor Dermot Curran, seconded by Councillor Roisin Mulgrew, it was agreed to note the content of report dated the 17th of January 22 from Mr A. McKay, Chief Planning Officer, and approve the preferred option, i.e. agree the revised service level agreement with Shared Environmental Services, in brackets CESS, and allow Shared Environmental Services to continue their work through the draft plan strategy stage. The last item on the order paper, item number 14, is the Tourism NI Product Development Fund SLA agreements. On the proposal of Councillor Roisin Mulgrew, seconded by Councillor Michael Savage, it was agreed that Councillor enter into service level agreements with Newry Mourne and Down tourism businesses detailed in the report to deliver a programme of events experiences as part of the Tourism NI Market-Led Product Development Programme 21-22. So that brings tonight's meeting to a close. I would like to thank everybody for attending and for making their contributions, and also to our officers and Democratic Services team for all the hard work and making this all work so, and run so smoothly. So thanks, everybody, and good night.
Thanks, Terry.